Come on aboard, I promise you. Lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Come on aboard. I promise you, it won't hurt the horde.
Have we started?
We're starting, sort of, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm cool with that. So I'm still trying to get fired up because I'm not dressed for this.
No. We're both a little overdressed for a sports podcast today. I've got the dress shirt and dress pants. You've got the blazer going.
I do, and the dress pants. I haven't worn dress pants to work in like 3 weeks. So, but I decided I was going to dress the part today, even I'm not sure why. It's my way of combating the weather. I don't know.
Yeah, but hey, I think we both look sharp.
Oh, for sure. Not denying that. Absolutely not. So anyway, this week, we've got a lot to talk about, Brian.
Yeah, a plethora of things to discuss.
You know, Brian and I get together on our off weeks, and we have like a little pre-production meeting where we talk about some things that we might want to attack in the next week or so, and something always happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sort of plan it out. We've got it's not an official rundown or a clock or any of those things that the radio people do. It's pretty loosey-goosey, I would say, but, you know, we have a plan, but something always happens.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of stuff happened in our off week.
A lot of things happened. We, for instance, had down to kind of talk about some of the backlash against Cam Newton that was leading up to and after the Super Bowl. It was a big deal was made of the fact that he didn't go. Well, he went, but he stormed out of his post-game press conference at the Super Bowl. And it was interesting that about 10 years ago when Peyton Manning lost a Super Bowl, he didn't even shake anybody's hand on the opposing sideline.
Right.
He just walked straight to the locker room, and that was that. And not too much was made of that, as I recall. Well, since we had that meeting, a whole lot of things have happened with Mr. Peyton Manning.
Well, doesn't the Super Bowl feel like it was like a year ago?
Yeah,
that it never happened.
Ancient
even?
History, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not even sure where to start. And actually, I wanted to ask you something, Brian. So, as I'm reading through this new, not new information about Peyton Manning and his years in college, was at University of Tennessee. Is that right?
Yep.
So, the information that has come out about his interactions with a trainer there as part of a much larger lawsuit, I believe, that's been brought against Tennessee.
Yes.
This has been bubbling under for a while. I think I remember hearing about something happening in the early 2000s. And so, but it always managed to get kind of swept under the rug to the point where you're like, did that happen? Am I dreaming it? Why do I feel a little unsettled when we talk about Peyton Manning? Like, it just sort of would pop up and then go away. Of course, now we're in a different era with social media and things never really go away. But wasn't there, I can't remember if it was Eli Manning or Peyton Manning or somebody else altogether who got in trouble for towel snapping a female reporter in a locker room. And I have Googled and I have Googled and I have Googled and I cannot find it. And I want
to
say it's Eli Manning, but it might have been Peyton Manning because it was probably before the year 2000, I'm guessing.
See, and this is, again, I'm like you. I don't really remember the incident specifically enough. My recollection of it was actually something to do with the New England Patriots. And I don't remember if it was specifically Brady, but I thought it was somebody with the Patriots.
Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. See, I don't know. That's the thing. It's like, if you Google like towel snapping female reporter, you get all kinds of craziness. So anyway, this information has come out. I think a gentleman from the New York Daily News sort of broke that story, even though it has sort of been bubbling under for a while, and then Sports Illustrated got a hold of it.
Sean King, I think, was the reporter for the Daily News.
Yes, right. Sean, S-H-U-N, I believe, not S-E-A-N, right?
Right.
S-H-A-U-N. Anyway, so, and all of a sudden, it's this huge deal, and it is a big deal. It is a big deal. If you read the document that he that was posted on the New York Daily News website, 72 pages, I think, or some something like that, it's just like it's gross. It's gross. And there's a, and there are a lot of things that are gross. And I don't think you have to be female to appreciate the gross factor of it. But there's other types of grossness, too. And some of the remarks by Peyton Manning's dad, for example, I thought were regarding her interactions with players of color.
Mm-hmm.
I thought were pretty unsavory, too. And as I told Brian in an email before the show, what is interesting to me about this whole culture around Peyton Manning and his interactions, and also the press and how they treat him, it's tons of tone policing. So Peyton Manning and his father are weirdly obsessed with the language of females, which I understand is a Southern thing. Like if you are a Southern woman of certain extraction and a swear word comes out of your mouth, and this is just hearsay, mm-hmm. but I lived in the South until I was about 12 years old, and so some of this rings kind of true. You were vulgar. Women didn't talk that way. That's not how a lady talks. So they have this, but in these documents, they talk about, you know, how she dropped a few F-bombs in the locker room. I mean, who doesn't do that, okay?
It's a locker room.
It's a locker room. And so, but he's not tone policing his teammates. He's tone policing this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the issue of tone policing on the larger stage now currently with this Cam Newton, you know, a young, gifted player of color in a, quote, traditionally white guy's position.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he's the boss of the offense on the field. And he wasn't behaving appropriately, according to the press. And it wasn't just the press conference. This was before.
Oh, yeah. Some of the, you know, the end zone celebrations,
right.
and things of
26
that
years old, or however old he is. I mean, come on. And so they're very interested in policing his actions as well,
mm-hmm.
holding him to a certain standard of behavior. And I don't know, Brian, I've nattered on enough. What do you think about all of this?
Well, my jaw doesn't often actually drop when I read something, but when I was reading Sean King's article for the New York Daily News about this, my jaw actually did drop at some of the things mm-hmm. in here, because just detailing some of these trainers' claims, and they were not unsubstantiated. There were several other witnesses, including at least one of Peyton Manning's teammates that corroborated her story. And then, that's one thing. And then I thought it really was in poor taste as well for Manning to mention this in a book, and that brought about another lawsuit. And I think that's the last time this really was in the media was some 12, 13 years ago. After Peyton Manning's book came out, kind of an autobiography, and I think it might have even been jointly written by he and Archie, and they mentioned this trainer in the book and mentioned her derogatorily, and as a result, she filed a defamation suit in 2002 about that, and finally that suit was settled. But you know, bottom line is this woman's very promising career in athletic training was gone.
Mm-hmm.
After all of this, I'm not sure what she's doing now, but that career basically was derailed at that point, which is awful. And for Peyton Manning just to kind of sail along with his multi-million-dollar contracts for both playing football and endorsements and everything else as kind of the all-American good guy, it just seems completely wrong to me.
Yeah, well, and you ask what she's doing now, and yesterday there was a piece on Deadspin. I think I sent that to you.
Yes.
And, you know, they asked the question, you know, this article was really not that much different than anything else I'd read, but they asked the question, you know, what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, at the end of the article, which we will include a link to it in the show notes, is, and I quote, There will still be a Hall of Fame jacket, well-deserved going by what happened on the field. And there will still be that opening speaker imploring all those in the Canton crowd to remember what a stand-up moral man Peyton Manning is, what a fine exemplar of the Tennessee Volunteers he turned out to be. So, you know, basically this person thinks that this isn't really going to go anywhere. I found the comments very interesting. In this piece, there were people from Tennessee weighing in. You know, this is Southern culture. You don't understand. Yeah, Tennessee kind of sucks. We've got a problem here. And then, yeah, I think a woman or somebody who said they were a woman from the South weighed in and just was like, well, she was a vulgar. She did have a vulgar mouth. It's just, and then somebody says, well, what is she up to now? You know, maybe what this timing is kind of suspicious. Maybe she's in some kind of trouble financially or whatever. So there's a lot of speculation there, and like there is on the internet. I mean, that's the flip side of shining a light on some of this stuff this way, is that you're going to have rampant other speculation by people who aren't in the position to investigate or write about it or mm-hmm. or whatever. So my question to you, Brian, is A, do you think times really have changed? I mean, has the advent of social media, is something going to happen here where it's going to really catch up with him if it's true? Is it going to be reinvestigated? Is it going to be shoved down the memory hole? I did notice yesterday I was having lunch at a wonderful eating establishment here in Urbana-Champaign called Black Dog, and mm-hmm. they had their TVs on, and nowhere in the ticker or anything was anything about this. Nowhere.
Interesting. Yeah, I've not been watching much of the worldwide leader lately, so I'm not sure what kind of coverage they've offered for this particular
story.
And
I was just there for a little while, and they were showing something else. So, but I didn't see it anywhere in their news,
right, the
coming
news
up, you know,
yeah,
the slide that they have for that. So
yeah,
anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen, to be honest. I would think it would make it even easier probably for Peyton Manning just to retire and kind of retreat mm-hmm. Away from the spotlight. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he does that. He might have anyway, but this might further prompt him to do that. And then if he does, then does the story just kind of fade away with him, you know, retiring? I don't know the answer to that. And I guess the other question is, was any possible criminal charge fully investigated? Or at this point, you know, this happened initially back in the mid to late 90s, mm-hmm. Are we dealing with a statute of limitations where he could no longer be prosecuted for something anyway?
Sure. Well, and there's an article that just came out on Bleacher Report today where the person writing it also talks about how it's okay to be skeptical and maybe we should just focus on the new allegations that are coming against Tennessee as opposed to excavating something from the past. I'm not sure how people feel about that, given, you know, Peyton Manning's status in the football sphere, his whole family, mm-hmm. really. I mean, and I think it's okay to shine a light on some of these things. That stuff was hidden away for a reason. Whether or not it's going to do much for her, it's going to hurt him, I guess. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But I sort of agree that in the here and now, we've got this other lawsuit that's mm-hmm. that's happening, and there's very definitely a culture with a problem there, and I'm sure at countless other schools. I mean, and you know, as a female, I can totally understand this desire to just not bring it up, just let it go, because it just makes your life a lot harder. I mean, this woman's career was ruined, if not by that, then certainly from some of that fallout and just having to move around and switch jobs and all that stuff. So it's yeah. pretty tough, but we'll provide some links to because I think the story is still unfolding in mm-hmm. a lot of ways, and that lawsuit, that much larger lawsuit in Tennessee is going to be going on for a long time, and there will be lots more to talk about in
yeah.
coming weeks.
We'll certainly keep our eyes on that as it unfolds. Meanwhile, another college athletic department with news this week, the University of Illinois.
We got a guy. And it's a guy. It is a guy. It's not a female, but we got a guy.
Yes. Josh Whitman has been, not officially as of this recording, but all reports are that Josh Whitman will be the next athletic director at the University of Illinois. He is expected to be introduced tomorrow, that per Ryan Baker with CBS in Chicago. former Illinois basketball manager back in his day. So he still got some inside sources at the university.
Oh, for sure.
And Whitman played football at the University of Illinois when Ron Turner was the coach here in the late 1990s.
So that was right after we moved here. We got here in 1996. So I don't remember him, but...
Yeah, I don't either. I got here right about the time, actually, that, that he would have graduated. I moved in the spring of 2000, which is about the time he was graduating from the university as an undergrad. Came back here for law school and served in the athletic department, so working on some special projects while he was in law school here. Then became the athletic director at Wisconsin La Crosse. Then moved to Washington University in St. Louis a couple of years ago. And now here he is moving up to the Big Ten level. Certainly, we've not heard of anything like at Tennessee, but the department has had certainly its issues for sure, mostly dealing with the welfare of athletes, whether it's Simon Svianovich or Casey Koni from the women's soccer team, some allegations from the women's basketball team as well. It will be interesting to me to see what Josh Whitman does when he comes here, what kind of house cleaning, so to speak, he does. There are some programs here that the high revenue programs, football and men's basketball, have certainly not been performing at a high level. With basketball this year, injuries played a part in that. Impossible to know how big a part, because you can't go back and play the games with a fully healthy team. But certainly that has been a part of Illinois' disappointing season on the basketball court. And then with football, you have a coach in Bill Cubitt who was given a two-year extension by the interim athletic director. And so everything's just kind of in limbo. And then you've got Matt Bolant, who's in his fourth year here with the women's basketball team. They've had not a good season. I think they're 1-12 in the Big Ten as we talk
this
Wednesday.
It's not been good.
So certainly a lot of decisions to be made by the new AD.
So that's my question. I haven't looked at his resume. I mean, you've just gone down the list of where he's been. Has he had to clean house before anywhere? Has he had to deal with problems like that, where maybe there's sort of a just an internal cultural, maybe I wouldn't even call it necessarily a problem as much as it is an atmosphere, an undercurrent sort of allowed behaviors? Or I'm curious if he's had to deal with that. You know, I was thinking about this last night because the university system's president, Timothy Killeen, prior to being here, where he was in the State University of New York system, and he kind of went to work there, kind of cleaning things up and, you know, putting them in a much better position, getting rid of the bad actors and all that. So, and then, you know, he's coming here and sort of laying the groundwork, has done some of that, even if it's been indirect. So I was thinking of this, of our new athletic director, our incoming athletic director, and if he's going to be doing, if he's got that experience.
That's a good question, and I have to admit I don't know enough about the athletic departments at Wisconsin La Crosse and Washington University in St. Louis to really know the answer to that. I know WashU is a D3 school. Wisconsin La Crosse,
I think they're D2.
Two or three, I know that. Yeah, I'm not sure which one off the top of my head, but I would guess that certainly he's not had to deal with it at that level, although looking back on his resume, as I recall, he actually also did some work in the NFL, I think, for an NFL team at some point, too, so maybe he's seen a little bit more of that, cleaning house at that level as well. I don't know.
So what do you think, by all accounts, you know, I was reading a little bit of the News Gazette last night and a couple other places, and everybody is just totally high on this guy. Like, don't you think those are some pretty heavy expectations to put? He's 37 years old, I think. So I'm like 10 years older than our new athletic director. I felt pretty old when I saw that, you know. I'm just wondering that, you know, he sounds like a great guy, just like the greatest guy. Played football. Everyone loved him. His teammates loved him. Love, love, love everywhere. He's going to law school, so he's super smart and whatever. So I just wonder if there's like this burden of really high expectations. Like he's the second or third or tenth coming of athletic directors here, and he's going to perform miracles. And I'm not saying he can't. I'm just saying I worry for him.
Well, he's got a lot of work to do, that's for sure. And you know, part of this, too, is there's just been so much instability here at the university level. There's still an interim chancellor, so his boss right. is an interim right now, Barb Wilson. No word on how quickly that chancellor search will move. And so that adds some uncertainty to it because, obviously, you know, the chancellor has some say on how things are run in the athletic departments as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainties here. So I don't I don't know, honestly, what how Josh Whitman's going to do. I would think that at least having been an athletic director at two different schools, he kind of has a feel for that role. Obviously, this is on a larger scale when you're going from D3 to D1, the Big Ten level. It's a much larger scale, but at least he's got some idea of how that role kind of works and some of the things there. And hopefully as well, he's got some connections to some of the alumni groups, some of right. the boosters right. and everything. Because one of the things I found out quickly in interviewing Mike Thomas a few times from my previous stop, he was traveling a lot. And it was a lot of times for fundraising. It was for networking with alumni.
Oh, sure.
That has become a huge part of the athletic director's job. And some of that had to do with the renovations for Memorial Stadium, the renovation for State Farm Center. But that's kind of an ongoing thing now. We are always out networking with alumni, raising money. And, you know, I'm not sure how much of that Whitman has done firsthand either. And that's going to be a huge part of his job.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, so I'm curious to see, like I said, there's all these accolades that have been heaped upon him. I'm very curious to see what his leadership style is. You know, I think here, just having been here for a while and watching how it's not, to me, it's not about the record that our teams have, although it's really nice to win. It's also just about how welcoming of a climate is it for student athletes. How do they fit in with the campus? Are they given like king and queen like status and kept away? And are the programs like dirty, not dirty? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I'm more about like, how do athletics fit into the whole of the campus and where we live and how do they integrate into academics and all that stuff? And so with him having been a student of pretty high caliber, obviously, my hope is that he's going to be able to just really sort of bring, I feel like at least locally here, and this could be true, I think, on a lot of college campuses where athletics, it's a big campus, the campus kind of dominates the community, athletics are a big deal, especially a Big Ten school. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's been a lot of discord and it's sort of fragmented and, you know, attendance hasn't been so great at games, and that could be because of the record, but not always. I think it's about, you know, people feeling included and good about the programs as a whole, and not mm-hmm. just how many games we've won.
Yeah, and I don't know what to make of this necessarily, but as I kind of look at some of the reaction, you know, of people who cover the program and their reaction to the choice, one thing that stood out to me is a couple of reporters who were covering the football team at the time that Whitman was on the team, Bob Osmussen of the News Gazette, mm-hmm. Herb Gould of the Chicago Sun-Times. Okay. Herb is retired in the last few years, but he was covering the team at that point. Mm-hmm. They both weighed in right away with columns basically saying that they really like the choice.
Yeah. His Osmussen's column was what I was referring to mm-hmm. when I said I read the News Gazette last
yeah,
night.
So. Yeah, yeah. So they remember him from his days as a player, and they kind of had the feeling, I think even at that point, that he was headed for big things, just the way he carried himself, you know, the type of teammate he was, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, for what that's worth, you know, they're on board and enthusiastic about the hire. Obviously, a long way to go, and we'll see what happens there.
Oh, yeah. No, lots to come, I'm sure.
Rivalry time, Lisa.
I wish we had rivalry music that we could punch in. Just like, is it trumpets? Is it like really intense, like mean-sounding music?
I might be able to find like some old NFL films music or something.
Oh, God, that would be hilarious.
Oh,
yeah. That'd be awesome. And so many, you know, we talk about rivalries, and some of the rivalries that we've talked about have been real rivalries, like where you sit, like, you know, when we talk about basketball teams that hate each other and they're like dropping each other on the court. And then we have more, we do have real rivalries, but they are useful to the players. And I'm thinking here of Borg and McEnroe. Mm-hmm. And then we also have rivalries that are almost completely manufactured by the press. And the press always has a role in helping create those rivalries and perpetuating those rivalries. But in the case that we're going to discuss today, or that I'm going to discuss today, because I'm not sure how up you are on this particular sport, especially from 40 years ago, we're going to talk about gymnastics, and we're going to talk about the, quote, rivalry between Olga Korbut, who was a Soviet gymnast, and Nadia Comăneci, who was from Romania. And I'm just going to start talking about them. Is that cool?
That's totally cool, because I know their names,
yes,
and I've seen little clips here and there, but
sure,
I did not really live through their dominance of women's gymnastics.
And you weren't a little girl in the early 70s who was a gymnast like I was. Now, so that's a little-known fact about me. I am 5'10", and clearly did not become a gymnast. But before, I guess, the team that I was on, the coach had never seen my dad, and he's 6'4". And as soon as he saw my dad, he's like, you should start learning how to play volleyball or basketball or something. And this was in Florida. And this was in the 70s. So I started in gymnastics classes sometime between the 1972 Olympics, where Olga Korbut, who was 18 at the time, sort of stole the show, and between the 1976 Olympics, where, unbeknownst to everyone, this little sprite named Nadia Comăneci was going to come in and blow everybody away. So every time I went to gymnastics class, everybody, all the girls had their hair like Olga Korbut, which is these two little pigtails with those wide yarn ribbons that were very popular in the 70s. Yeah, so we all wore those, and I really wanted a red leotard with a white stripe because, you know, that's kind of what she wore, although she wore lots of other leotards. But for whatever reason, I really focused on that. And I wanted to be like her. And the thing about Olga Korbut is she really sort of ushered in the first wave of, like, how did she do that? She was very daring. There are moves that she performs on the bars, and we'll have links to videos in the show notes. There were moves that she would perform on the uneven parallel bars that they got rid of. Like, you can't do anymore. There's one where she stands on the top bar and does a back flip off of it and catches it again. And it was just, and other gymnasts would do it too, but, like, it's been disallowed for a really long time. She would do, she was also very flexible and, like, way beyond what you would normally see for a gymnast. And would do the stuff on the balance beam where it was just like, even when I was little, I was like, I'm never going to be able to do that. I'm just not made this way. So anyway, I was very much looking forward to the 1976 Olympics because Olga Korbut was going to be there. And so the 76 Olympics come. They were in Montreal. The 72 Olympics were in Munich. They come, and Olga Korbut is now 22 years old, and she's injured. She's got something going on. I can't remember what the injury was, an ankle maybe. So she wasn't 100%. Oh, no. Like, what was going to happen with the gymnastics? So enter this tiny little person named Nadia Comăneci. She was 14 years old at the time. And the second I saw her on the uneven bars, I was like, oh, I want to be like her. You're done. And so she gets on the uneven bars and she gets the first perfect 10 in Olympic history. Like, even the scoreboard is not equipped to show that. It looks like she got a 1.0 because they don't know how else to show it. So you had Olga Korbut sort of ushering in this flexibility and this, like, first wave of athleticism. Nadia Comăneci sort of brought that, but this absolute, like, rhythmic beauty to gymnastics as well, that was not like what it was in the 60s where it was super ladylike. It's this combination of this raw athleticism, but also she was like a dancer. I mean, she barely looked like she was touching any apparatus that she was touching. And she was really young and small, so I could relate to her more. I mean, Olga Korbut had definitely, you know, grown more. She'd probably cracked 5'2 by that time, and Nadia Comăneci was like 4'11, and so she was just more relatable. So as the Olympics are going and they're going through their events, the press totally manufactured this rivalry. Like,
sure.
Oh, my God, you know, the queen is going to be dethroned by this, you know, upstart from Romania. And that's kind of what happened in a lot of ways. I mean, Nadia Comăneci, I believe, won the all-around that year gold mm-hmm. medal.
Yeah.
The Romanian team got the silver medal. I believe the Soviet team came in first. They had another gymnast on their team named Nellie Kim, who was just fantastic. And Olga Korbut, she did okay. You know, she was playing hurt, so it was kind of rough. But gymnastics exploded in the United States after Nadia Comăneci. And Bela Karoly, you know, we've talked about him. He mm-hmm. eventually came to the United States and then basically ushered in this third wave, and I would argue the current wave of not – it's not so much grace and it's not so much like, you know, flexibility in these like amazing feats of daring. It is pure, unadulterated athleticism. These women who are doing gymnastics now are indistinguishable. I mean, you cannot even, they are totally unrelated to the women who were doing gymnastics when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Just their builds, the kinds of stuff they're doing, the, you know, for Korbut having her move totally discontinued because it was too dangerous. I mean, we're seeing things all the time in the gymnastics world now where I can't even believe some of the stuff they do. And if you watch Nadia Comăneci or Olga Korbut on on their apparatus, you're kind of like, what's the big deal? But it was huge for that time.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there's a picture, and we'll include this on the webpage too, of sort of like the changing of the guard where Nadia Comăneci is on the podium, like, waving to everyone. And Olga Korbut is looking up at her from the silver medal position, kind of like with a little smirk, like, yep, okay, you got me, you know. And then both women moved on they kept going for a little while. Both are coaches now. I believe Nadia Comăneci married Bart Connor, who was a male gymnast from the mm-hmm. United States, and they run a gym now. And Olga Korbut was a coach, too, and I think both of them live here. So it was just a really, you know, powerful rivalry. It was like the first one that I noticed because I was really interested in the sport. And I had really wanted to be like one gymnast. And then my tensions got diverted to being like this other gymnast. And then I grew to be 5'10 and was never a gymnast. But I still watch.
Fun fact about Nadia Comăneci.
Okay.
She retired from competition when she was 19 years old.
Wow.
She was 14 at the Montreal Olympics.
Yes. Oh, yeah. She was a kid. She was a kid, you know, and gymnastics is like modeling, okay? Like mm-hmm. for women anyway, you know, these models get discovered when they're 12 or 13 years old. They haven't even like grown yet or whatever. And then their careers often are over in their early 20s. If you're super famous, you get to go on like Cindy Crawford. She's retiring this year and she'll be 50 or something. So, but a lot of it has to do, Nadia Comăneci's physique changed a lot as she went through puberty. It just mm-hmm. did. When her little girl physique went away, it's harder to do the things that you, like your brain still thinks you can do it and your body's like, wait a minute, you know, like I think I could still do a round off backhand spring, but I would kill myself if I tried. And that's not just age. It's also center of gravity. It's like the physics of it change as you change. So mm-hmm. But anyway, so I've talked not as much about the rivalry because they didn't really have one with each other. The teams sort of had rivalries, but they were both behind the Iron Curtain. Everybody just, you know, so they were kind of two Americans. They were all kind of on the same team, you know. But it definitely went, you know, Korbut came first, then Comăneci, and then Mary Lou Retton. And now, and I think after that, you kind of have what you have today,
mm-hmm.
modern gymnastics.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. Very interesting, short-lived rivalry in women's gymnastics, but it certainly changed the sport forever.
It really did. It really did. Thank you for letting me talk about gymnastics, Brian, because not many people would listen to me talk about it.
It's quite all right. Very interesting stuff. And that we're going to have to say goodbye for this edition of The Bandwagon. Good news for all you summer sports fans, pitchers and catchers reporting this week.
Well, that is good news. Hope they have some nice weather because it hasn't been that great here. It's hard to think about baseball for me, but go them.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're all in good shape and ready to rumble.
Best shape of their lives.
I doubt that, but. So are we done here?
We are.
Wrapping up?
We're
all right.
Wrapping up.
All right, here we go. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for joining us today on The Bandwagon, where we feel compelled to remind you that there is plenty of room for everyone. Bandwagon is produced by us. I'm Lisa Braltz, and
I'm Brian Moline.
Brian records us and edits us and puts us on the web, and I handle a lot of our pre-production, such as it is. You can email us if you really want to know what any of that means. Scott Cameron is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs. This podcast is really all his fault, so you can direct all your complaints to him. Mm-hmm. The fun photos of us on the World Wide Web were taken by Mike Thomas, not the former U of I Athletic Director, but Illinois Public Media's Art Director. Our theme song is by some band of now old dudes from Athens, Georgia. I think they're called REM.
Retired.
Oh, I guess, yeah, I guess they are. Man, that's... Stop it. Stop it. All credit to Jim Kelly for suggesting the song. So remember how we promised there might be a dedicated Bandwagon webpage this week? Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't happen. Oh. So for now, you can locate past episodes of The Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu, as well as links to the articles we discuss and some show notes and maybe even some videos, definitely some gymnastics videos this time. We would love your feedback via email, or if you'd prefer to start a conversation online, you can go ahead and ping us on Twitter. I'm at Lisa Braltz, and
I'm at B Moline, W-I-L-L.
Cool. So the next episode of The Bandwagon is coming your way the week of February 29th, Leap Day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'll record on Leap Day. Well, we might. I don't know. Will we have a webpage by then?
Perhaps.
Stranger things have happened. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening.
Catch you later.